Let's open our Bibles this morning, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 14. You know, we have nicknames for people. Sometimes we call them the name other than their given name. And Jesus did that once in a while. He called one guy Rock, you know, Peter. He called James and John the Sons of Thunder. That sounds like something from Marvel Comics. He called the Pharisees vipers. That wasn't complimentary. It's because of the way they were living. They were poison. Sometimes Jesus referred to people as you of little faith. He said that to his own disciples a few times. Now, what that means is that people of faith can sometimes be lacking in faith. Are you with me? People of faith can sometimes be lacking in faith. Or, stated another way, believers in Jesus with sins forgiven and a home in heaven can still at times lack confidence in God. As believers, we trust Him for the forgiveness of sins, but then doubt Him in the day-to-day experiences. Or stated another way, we who have trusted in Him sometimes don't trust Him. Are you picking up what I'm laying down? All right, I'll say it another way. We don't lose our salvation, but we also don't live our salvation. When we are not trusting God, when we are living in unbelief, though we are believers, when we're living in unbelief, there's evidence of that. There's symptoms. There's signs. The big one, of course, is worry. When we're fretting and you know, sometimes we say, "Oh, I'm not worried. I'm just concerned." You know, it's another way of saying the same thing. I'm doubting whether God's got a handle on this or not. Another evidence of unbelief would be fear. When we're living in constant fear, that's a sign of unbelief. It's a symptom of unbelief. It doesn't mean you're not a Christian. It just means you're not living in the fullness of God's presence, power, and resting in Him. We could add to that list lying. You know, when we lie, we're doubting that God can take care of our situation, so we got to take care of it for ourselves. Stealing, even hoarding. All of these things are symptoms of unbelief. There's another sign, and one that we want to talk about in the text today, that when we fail to believe God, we often take things into our own hands. When we get tired of waiting on God to take some action, sometimes we think He needs our help. So we got to step in and do something to help Him. Remember the Old Testament story of Abraham and Sarah? God wasn't working fast enough, and so Sarah came up with the brilliant idea of Abraham fathering the child through her handmaid, and we all know how that went and what we're still experiencing as a result of it. Bad idea. Jacob had a few of those moments in his life where he took things into his own hands, and a guy that we'll talk about quite a bit over the coming months, a guy that we have been talking about, Saul. Saul was often guilty of taking things into his own hands. Now, it's easy to accuse Saul and see these flaws in his life. But truth be told, we manifest some of the same traits of unbelief as Saul did. On a much smaller scale, we're not kings here. But it's not only kings that manifest unbelief in some unique ways. We do this at church sometimes. We do this at home. We do this at work. What kind of signs am I talking about in this particular situation? Well, here you go. Here's a list, all right? Authoritarianism. Manipulation. Intimidation. Legalism. Psychological and spiritual abuse through the use of fear and guilt and passive-aggressive behaviors. Whew! Those words were probably triggers for some of you, and I don't mean to do that today, but those are all signs of unbelief. They're signs that we're trying to take things into our own hands. When we refuse to trust God, we'll take things into our own hands, and we'll get really creative in the ways that we try to make things right. the ways that we try to make things happen, and they often result in forms of spiritual abuse. Now, we're going to see it today in the life of Saul, and if any of this is like looking in a mirror, then let's repent and confess if necessary, because one of the reasons we look at these characters is so we can say, oh, you know what, I need to grow in that area. It's not so we can sit back and go, oh, he was a bad man. That's right, yep, he was bad, and I'm good, and it's all good. No, we look at these characters and we go, oh, you know what, I can see that in my own life, and we want to deal with that, all right? Last week, we learned that Jonathan's faith-filled courage was a catalyst that resulted in the rout of the Philistine army. Because of Jonathan's initial actions, that was, and let me be very clear about something here, this was an initiative that was subject to God's will, all right? Somewhere you need to note that. Some of you might think I'm not preaching yet, that I won't start preaching until I get to the Bible. I'm in the Bible. I'm there. I have started. All right, we're doing this. And our initiative must always be subject to God's will. Not all initiative is right. Jonathan was working with God. Remember what he said as he was climbing up? He said, this is going to be the sign that if God is in this, then this is what's going to happen. If it's not, we're going to do that. He had initiative, but it was always subject to God's will. And so he subjected himself to God, and God brought about this catalyst to this great victory, and they chased the Philistines 15 miles, and then they stopped. Now let's see what happened next, starting in verse 24. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemies." So none of the people tasted food. Now all the people of the land came to a forest, and there was honey on the ground. And when the people had come into the woods, there was the honey dripping. But no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. Therefore he stretched out the end of the rod that was in his hand and dipped it in a honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his countenance brightened. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. But Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. Look now, how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they had found. For now would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines?" At some point in this pursuit, Saul, taking things into his own hands, made a foolish rule. This is an initiative that is not according to God's will. This is just his own doing. The New King James is not as clear as some of the other translations, but, for example, the New English translation says it this way: Saul made the army agree to an oath. He made everybody agree to this oath. What they agreed to was that they would fast until evening. Now, fasting is a good idea when praying. Fasting is not a good idea when fighting. All right? Clearly, it was the Lord who was putting these enemies into this panicked flight. So why would Saul feel like he needed to make such a foolish rule? And I think it's clear from the text because Saul was starting to make this about himself. Did you notice he said, "Before I have taken vengeance on my enemies"? Huh. Well, when did this become about you, Saul? This wasn't about your enemies. This wasn't your battle. This battle belonged to the Lord. These weren't his personal enemies. But when we start making things about ourselves, we start leaving God out. And when we start leaving God out, we're more likely to take things into our own hands. And I think that's clearly what's happening in this passage. Saul made a foolish rule, and he forced people to abide by it, and by putting them under an oath that if they violated it, they would die. Now, Jonathan had been out fighting, and he wasn't aware of this rule, and therefore he didn't agree to it. And he and all the troops that joined him had walked into this wooded area that was loaded with honey. It says it was dripping. Isn't that great? Dripping honey. It's dripping on the ground. I mean, hallelujah, you know. All this dripping honey. And so he takes his staff and he stuck it in the honeycomb and he brought it up and he slithered some off and he licked it and it brightened his countenance. That's what snacks do. Yeah, snacks brighten the countenance. I mean, it's biblical, you know. His eyes became bright, it says. Now imagine all the other guys looking at that. They're tired. Jonathan's over there. And they're over there. Can you see it? He's enjoying this. And I got to think that he's wondering, how come nobody else is doing this? Guys, it's dripping. Nobody's moving. So one of the guys explained what happened and why all the people were faint. And in verse 29, Jonathan's response was, well, that was dumb. I mean, that's my translation, but that's what he's saying. He's saying, well, that was really dumb. Why would you do that? He said, my father troubles the land. If we had all gained a little strength, we would have had an even greater victory. Meaning, they stopped short of everything God wanted to give them because they were exhausted. Saul's authoritarianism did not help. It actually squelched what God was doing. He was getting in the way. But he was the king, and he had his way. You ever done that? You're like, well, I'm not a king. No, but you're a parent. Have you ever said that as a parent? Your kid says, why? Because I don't have a good reason, except I'm the boss. No, I'm not saying you have to explain everything to your children. And if any of your kids are going, yeah. I'm simply saying that sometimes when we're in a position of authority, we think we don't have to have any reason. We think we don't have to have any, because then it's about us, see? And Saul was going to have his way. We've done this as parents. We've made dumb rules just to win. Legalism in the church is the same thing. It's making of rules that don't make any sense. It doesn't advance the mission. It usually just discourages people that are in the trenches. This kind of behavior is present in spiritually abusive relationships, and it's rooted in unbelief. So now what? Well, let's see what happened next. Verse 31. Now they had driven back the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, so the people were very faint. And the people rushed on the spoil and took sheep, oxen, and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, look, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. So he said, you have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone to me this day. Then Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep. Slaughter them here and eat. Do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. This was the first altar that he built to the Lord. So the people kept Saul's man-made rule and didn't eat the honey. But then when the sun set and the day was over and the oath no longer applied, they rushed onto the spoil and started slaughtering the animals and eating them raw. Now, I have rushed onto a bag of potato chips. All right, I do that. I understand that I read that I need more fiber in my diet, and potato chips have 1 gram of fiber. So I'm eating more chips now is what I'm doing to make up for that. But I will rush on to a bag of chips, but I'm going to tell you, I've never rushed on raw meat. I was in a little restaurant one time, and all the tables were very close together, and this lady that was sitting at another table, I didn't know who she was, she ordered liver, which is bad at the beginning. And then she said, and I want it raw. I like it jiggly. No, seriously, that's what she said. And I had ordered a pizza. I didn't even want to eat after I heard that. I like it jiggly? Seriously? Yeah, some of you are not going to want lunch right now, you know. But, I mean, this is what these guys did. They were so hungry. They were so famished, they didn't even cook anything. They just killed this stuff and started eating it. Raw. That people were not to eat meat with blood still in it was a rule from God. That was a rule that actually predated the law of Moses. It goes all the way back to Noah in Genesis chapter 9, verse 4. It's reiterated in the law in Leviticus chapter 17 and verse 11, where it says, the life of the flesh is in the blood, and blood makes atonement for the soul. All the way back, God was making something very clear about the blood, that the blood is sanctified, that the blood is holy, that the blood has special purpose. And of course, we're coming to this table today to remember the blood of our Lord and his atonement for us. But there's something sanctified about the blood. Now, it seems like if they had been able to eat some snacks throughout the day, they wouldn't have been so famished as to eat raw meat at the end of the day. It often happens this way. People keep the man-made rule and then ignore the law of God. One time Jesus rebuked the Pharisees because they let their tradition actually nullify the word of God. Listen to these verses from Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15, verses 1 through 9. Then the scribes and the Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to Jesus saying, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders, for they don't wash their hands when they eat bread? He answered and said to them, and why do you transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? Nice, Jesus. He goes on, for God commanded, saying, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, whoever says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me, I'm now giving to God. In other words, the Pharisees were saying, I'm not going to help my parents who are in need. I'm going to give what I was going to give to them to God, as if that's really holy somehow. Then he need not honor his father or mother. That was the rule of the Pharisees. Then he says this, Jesus says this. I'm in Matthew 15. Thus you have made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition. You hypocrites. Well did Isaiah prophesy about you, saying, these people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. This just doesn't go away. Failure to trust God, failure to believe, caused Saul to take things into his own hands. And Saul ended up creating an environment where people were more concerned about his rules than they were about God's. Are you familiar with this phrase, virtue signaling? You know what that means, virtue signaling? It goes back a long ways. In this case, you were a good soldier if you fasted, if you kept the rule. But actually what you become is a tired and weak and ineffective soldier. And think of all the ways that we do this kind of thing in our culture and even in the church, you know. Right? These days, If you drive a certain car, you're good. But if you drive an oil-spewing, gas-guzzling Jeep Wrangler, you're bad. Or if you vote a certain way, you know, you're good. And if you vote another way, you're bad. Or if you shop on a certain day and you don't shop on another day, then you're good or you're bad. That's virtue signaling. You know, you can do all that virtue signaling stuff and still be a rotten person to the core. And friends, this stuff, this doesn't go away. It just doesn't go away. And it's true in our, it's true within the confines of Christianity. A foolish rule gets kept, and then a real sin follows. Like dominoes, unbelief. Once it begins, it just continues to topple. So verse 35, Saul tries to fix this. He makes an altar and a large stone, and he makes the people slaughter the animals there. He tries to sanctify a bad situation. Now, it had been a long day. They had fasted, and then they ate a bunch of raw meat like a bunch of orcs. And then Saul had the brilliant idea of marching at night to surprise the Philistines in the morning. Look at this, verse 36. Now Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And the people said, "Whatever." No, they did. That's what they said. If you look at it, I mean, they said, "Do whatever seems good to you," but that's what they're doing. Whatever. Then the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." So Saul asked counsel of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day. And Saul said, "Come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and know and see what this sin was today. For as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not a man among all the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, "You shall be on one side, and my son Jonathan and I will be on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Whatever." Verse 41, "Therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, 'Give a perfect lot.' So Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, 'Cast lots between my son Jonathan and me.' So Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, 'Tell me what you have done.' And Jonathan told him and said, 'I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand, so now I must die.' Saul answered, 'God do so, and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan.' But the people said to Saul, 'Shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day.' So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die." At Saul's order, the people said, "All right, whatever you want to do." But the priest said, "How about we stop and draw near to God right now?" And as I was studying this, I said right out loud, "Yes! Yes, finally!" That might be one of the best sentences in this whole book. Let us draw near to God here. It's the Lord's battle. They were the Lord's people. Those were the Lord's enemies. And before another dumb rule gets made and an all-night march gets started, let's stop and pray. You know, when we're on the unbelief train and it's going downhill, very often one of the ways the Lord tries to stop us is by other people. And when that person says, "Maybe we should stop and pray about this," you better stop, drop, and pray. I mean, I'm just telling you, friends, I've been on the unbelief train going downhill, and I've had people get in my way. And I haven't always been happy about it when they got in the way. I'm happy now. Looking back, I can see who people who said, you know what, maybe we ought to stop and pray about this right now. And I went, great idea. If somebody gets in your way and wants to stop you to pray, that'd be a really good idea. Now in verse 37, Saul says, shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel? But God did not answer him that day. You know, when we ask God something, he is under no obligation to answer when we want him to answer. He's God. Does it ever drive you crazy when you text somebody and they don't text you back right away? I mean, isn't that the point of texting? To get an immediate answer? I texted a guy yesterday morning. He still hasn't texted me back. I'm starting to get mad. I'm starting to think he doesn't like me. Some of you are looking at your phone right now. Well, I hope it's not me, man. No, seriously, we're kind of at the point in life where we expect an answer like right now. It's not an email, it's a text. And sometimes when we think about God, we think, I asked him. I mean, how come I'm not getting an answer here? Well, God's under no obligation to answer you on your timetable or mine. Now, when he doesn't answer, very often that simply means wait. That's what it means. That's your answer. Sometimes it means he's leaving the decision to us. God does do that too, you know. Sometimes God says, well, what do you want? And then we have the opportunity to do that. A lot of freedom, honestly. Sometimes it means we have something between us. David wrote this in Psalm 66. I'm reading from the NIV here. It says, if I had cherished sin in my heart, the Lord would not have listened. But God has surely listened and heard my voice in prayer. Praise be to God who has not rejected my prayer or withheld his love from me. I mean, there's so much positive in that verse that God is eager to answer on his timetable. He loves his kids. But if we're going to sin and rebel and have a hard heart, we get in the way. See? Verse 38 then indicates that Saul's assumption was that somebody had sinned, that he was not getting an answer because somebody else sinned. Well, duh. There was a bunch of guys with blood on their bibs. How about that? But he said, with God as my witness, even if it's Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die. You know, there's a phrase that has been around a long time, and it goes something like this. Do right, though the stars fall from heaven. And I've read a couple of biographies of Abraham Lincoln, and I read that one time somebody said that to him, and he said, well, stars falling from the heavens would be a fairly significant event. We should really make sure we're right. In other words, he was concerned about collateral damage. In our passion for what is right, in our passion for justice, we should carefully consider collateral damage. I was talking to a guy not long ago. He's a missionary. He said to me, I think the whole church is messed up, all of it, everything. Big churches, small churches, medium churches, they're all messed up. We should burn it all to the ground and start over. And I said, wow, there might be a lot of good people in the flames. Have you considered the collateral damage? You know, we have this mindset sometimes that we get this idea that God doesn't know what's right anymore and that the world's a mess and we got to take care of the whole thing. Burn it all down and start over? I don't know, Jesus said something about tares and wheat. Remember that? Then if you rip up all the weeds, you might pull out some of the wheat at the same time. How about we wait till the end of the age and let the Father and his angels sort that all out? Saul didn't care about collateral damage. He cared about being obeyed. He was going to have his way, and he wanted to find out who the sinner was. And so he inquired of the Lord by way of lots. He assumed it wasn't him. And in the lots, Jonathan was selected. So Saul said to him, "What have you done?" Now, obviously, the thing that's on everybody's mind here was Saul's rule and not the raw meat. That honey in the woods episode was the problem because Saul had put people under this oath. In verse 43, Jonathan either just owned it like a man and said, "Well, then, I'm going to die." Or, and this is my opinion, he said it sarcastically. Because, you know. Once in a while, I'm sarcastic. And I sort of see it there. I feel like he was saying right here, you know, okay, yeah, right. So I taste a little honey, and now I must die. And Saul, so impressed with his own dumb rule and so convinced that his own son was the real problem, said, "Yes, you must die." Here was a guy who had gone so far in taking things into his own hands, he was willing to sacrifice his own son for his dumb rule. This is the zenith of unbelief. Verse 45, it was obvious to everybody else that this had gone far enough. And so the people jumped in and they said, "Jonathan has initiated this great deliverance. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall. He is the one who has worked with God this day." He wasn't out in front of God. He wasn't behind God. He wasn't trying to take God's place. He worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. And you know what? Saul should have been humiliated right there and admitted that his rule was dumb. But rather, he went home, and the Philistines went to their home. And what could have been a complete victory was cut short. Now, the closing paragraph of this chapter is a summary of what the Lord did under Saul's reign, and by God's grace, some really good things still happen under Saul's reign. We also meet some more of Saul's family in this last paragraph, and we're going to come back to that at another time. But I hope one of the main things we see in this text is that there are dangerous things that can happen when we fail to trust God and when we try to take things into our own hands. Now, when we're reading these stories, I tell you, and when I'm reading through the Old Testament, I sometimes get a little tired of the battles and the blood and the mayhem. And sadly, these battles, this blood and mayhem are still going on. The Philistines and the Jews are still in conflict. Palestinians, Philistines. They're still in conflict. And I at the risk of sounding political here and getting a lot of emails, I just want to say they're all wrong. You're like, "Wait, don't you side with Israel?" Well, I side with the truth. I side with mercy. And there's this is all wrong. It's all messed up. This hatred, this bloodshed, it puts the whole region and all the people in a state of unrest, and it does not bring about the flourishing life of its people. And you know what it is? It's proof positive every day that we're still living east of Eden. Are you familiar with that phrase? East of Eden. It's from Genesis chapter 3, verse 24. It's the gate that got closed. We're not back to Eden yet. Greenville is not Eden. Can't create it no matter how hard you try. And this, friends, is precisely why Jesus came. He came to deliver us from the kind of life that we've been reading about in this text, this Old Testament life of mayhem and bloodshed. And he came to deliver us from the kind of life that's taking place around the world today. He came with a forgiveness way of heart. He came full of grace and truth. He died on the cross. He rose from the dead. He sent his Spirit and left his word so we wouldn't keep killing each other and striving over land and rights and all this stuff. He came to remind us that because he is here, we don't have to take life into our own hands. We can trust him and we can leave outcomes to him.